Here it is, the final Friday in the entire year of 2023. And while it's not the final episode of season four, still, welcome back to season four of the podcast. Of course, as always, I'm your host, Amanda Blackwood. As many of you know, I did write my autobiography as a survivor of human trafficking. It's called Custom Justice. But if you didn't know that, you do now. Keeping in line with that, this entire season has been focused on interviewing people who did or plan to write about their own experiences as trauma survivors. But today is a little bit different. Welcome back to the podcast. As always, I'm your host, Amanda Blackwood. I have with me a very special guest today. She's not here to talk about her own traumas, but what it means to be somebody who's working through the foster care system, which I think, as a lot of people know, there's a lot of trauma that's related to that. Debbie Osborne is just absolutely incredible. And I didn't want to say this before I brought her on the show, but she's a bit of a hero to me. I was a foster kid myself. So thank you for what you do, Debbie. Thank you for what you've done, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
I am so excited to talk to you about everything that you've been through. First question out of the gate is always, where are you originally from? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in North Georgia. My family is hillbilly from way back when.
That's awesome.
Yes. So as I pointed out to my husband before we got married, I grew up in Deliverance country, honey. So.
Don't make me sidesteps.
That's right. Don't make me start playing the banjo.
What made you want to get into being a foster parent?
Oh, goodness. It was a long journey. I grew up with parents who were always working with, back then we called them at-risk kids. And so I had that example of watching them try to work with kids and provide some sort of stability to kids from dysfunctional families through church and various avenues of working with them. And then when I got out of college, I graduated with a degree in education and realized that I didn't want to be a teacher. My 1-on-30 skills were not very good, but my 1-on-1 skills were okay. So I got a job as a probation officer / social worker with the juvenile court outside Atlanta, and just, you know, ended up neck deep in all the problems of various kids and why they end up in foster care and the things that they need and the trauma that they were suffering. And even when I burned out after 3.5 years and retreated, law school seemed to be a better option than becoming an alcoholic at the time. So I kept my passion for working with kids, and I knew that even as a single person who, you know, had a career that I enjoyed and was interested in, I didn't want that to be my whole life, and I knew that there was a problem, and I had not all the skills, but enough skills to not screw up somebody else's life. So I knew there was a need. So that's where I started. And I will say, ironically, it's interesting. I was a federal prosecutor and worked with, prosecuting child abuse cases, and sort of all of my background as a social worker came into effect for that. But then I also, when I came back into private practice, started working with a lot of the groups that I had once been employed by, a lot of the youth serving organizations. So my life is surrounded by working with kids.
Wow. And being in that position, in a position of authority over their lives, when you're not actually their parent, I know this has got to be a huge struggle. I mean, this is massive. What's some of the stuff that you've had to deal with them having gone through traumas of their own before coming into your household?
Well, I think the most frustrating thing is, yes, we're in positions of authority, but we don't really have any power because, kids make their own decisions. They have autonomy. And parenting a child with trauma is, no matter how much I learn, no matter how much I know, it is not like a recipe where you can add three parts of love and two parts of patience and say I love you for 3 weeks and then bake in the oven for 6 months and they get their act together or you get your act together. It's always very flawed people. And of course we as adults, there's always things about the question, what would you tell your younger self if you had a chance to go back in time? And there's a lot that I would tell my younger self and things that I tell my kids, but my younger self wouldn't listen to me. I didn't much listen to anybody. So we're just our human brains, we are just wired to learn from experience and not from words or lectures.
Right. How does your faith play into raising foster kids and stepkids?
Well, it at core, it is what I know God wants me to do. It is the sense of, my faith, which is conservative Protestant, says that my job is to care for the widow and the orphan, and that I am supposed to care for them, but at the same time, I have to walk humbly and realize that I don't have all of the answers and that we are on this journey together. And so I am pointing them in what I think is the right direction, but God has not put me on any admissions committees to heaven. So I have to say what I believe to be true, but say it in love and humility.
When you're going through all of this and you've got foster kids in your house, I know there's got to be these moments where you have to deal with the biological parents because you've got visitation and all that kind of stuff. I went through foster care at 17 years old. And while my parents did not have visitation, I had a 16-year-old foster kid myself just last year, and there
Oh,
was
wow.
biological parent visitation. And that was tough. How do you deal with that
Yes.
kind of stuff?
Well, I actually working with my kids' foster parents was great training for being a step parent and working with my stepkids and my biological mother and my husband's ex-wife. So there were things that I learned from working with the kids. First thing is that we can never replace the biological parents. Kids want to live with their biological parents. And no matter how wonderful we are simply not the person who's supposed to be there. And we have to accept that we are the plan B parent. And that's okay. It's fine to be the plan B parent. That can be just as rewarding and wonderful. So we have to understand we don't take it personally,
Right.
Not long after we got married, my husband's ex-wife filed for cu my husband had custody at the time we were married, and my husband's ex-wife filed for custody of the kids. And we were trying to find out what the youngest son, he was really the only one he was the only one young enough to be at issue. And he wasn't going to say anything that sounded like he was picking sides. And we didn't want him to pick sides. We just didn't want to spend a lot of resources going down a path that he was opposed to. And my husband finally said to him, "Well, if you had a magic wand, what would happen here?" And our son didn't hesitate. He looked at him and said, "Well, if I had a magic wand, you and mom would still be together."
Oh.
And then there was this pause, and then he looked over at me and said, "No insult, Debbie. You and the dogs would be right next door." And I understood where he was coming. Understand, this kid he and I bonded early on and we adore each other. But it was not about me. It was simply about his world was out of kilter. And that's the way I don't understand with foster kids, you know, if the world worked the way it was supposed to be, I wouldn't be in their lives, or I would be at most the nice neighbor lady next door who fed them cookie. So once you understand that the most of the resistance may not be about you, it's just their world is out of kilter. Then the second thing is you have to keep your mouth shut about the biological parents. It's not, you know, it's not your, their relationship is not your problem, and you provide support. Now, that being said, you do have to help the kids understand the dividing line between their parents' problems and the kids' problems, and try to help the kids keep from taking on their parents' problems. But you have to do that very delicately, and you have to have set up a good foundation of trust before you ever go there. Until you do that, you just keep your mouth shut and provide whatever support you can.
And that is such fantastic advice. Now, when I was in foster care at 17, the people that I was staying with knew nothing of my family. They knew nothing of my circumstances. And I wasn't at a point yet where I was willing or able to talk about it.
Right.
You know? Right. And they didn't try to probe or ask me questions like, why are you here? And what happened to you? You know, their teen daughter did, but that's different. You know, that's well, a kid.
Right. Right.
Kids are curious. They want to know, how is your life so much different from my life? Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And trying to understand where things fit in the world. That's just what kids do.
Right. Right. And it made total sense to me at the time. And if I felt like I was going to tell them something, I would tell them, hey, look, you're not going to probably like what you hear, but I'm going to tell you anyway, because you asked. Right. And that kind of honesty, I think, was helpful. But it's rare to have that kind of honesty as a teenager. And looking back, I recognize that now.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So when
is,
you
that
say,
is unusual.
Yeah. When you say that commitment is stronger than love, what do you mean?
I mean that we don't always love our kids. We don't always even like them. But yeah. we have to hang in there anyway, until because we made the commitment, and we have to show them that we are there for them. And, you know, the emotions will follow the commitment. That I joke about, there are days, you know, when I married my husband, we love each other, and we made the promise to till death do us part. But, you know, there are always days when you think, why the heck did I do this? And I don't think I can keep doing it. And you realize, you just say, all right, I will get through one more day, and then I'll think about it again. Sometimes the only way through a tough time in a relationship is to just say, I'm going to do this because I said I would do it. And with our kids, you know, we're setting up relationships, and it may be a tough relationship. It may be a dysfunctional relationship, but it is still a relationship. And the only way to build a strong relationship is to just follow through on that commitment. My youngest son was always, when I first got married, he was always very paranoid that I was going to go off on one of my business trips and not come back. And there was always a lot of anxiety and angst, and it gradually got better. And I asked him 5 or 6 years ago why he quit worrying about that so much. And he thought for a minute and said, well, you're still here.
You kept coming back.
Kept coming back. And you can't just tell kids, I will be here. You have to be there.
Yeah. Yep. Especially those that have had abandonment issues that have come from divorced families or single parent households. That's so hard on them.
Right. And especially kids who have been abandoned a lot, or moved around a lot, or you know, they know how to play the system and get themselves moved to a new placement. And sometimes the only control they feel like they have is to get themselves moved before they get kicked out. Yes. So, you know, to say to them, I learned not to say to them too soon, you're here as long as you, you know, this is your home, as long as you want it to be your home. Because as soon as I said that, they started testing, like, oh, yeah.
I'll show you.
Easy enough to say. Let's just see how much you mean that.
Yeah. And, you know, they're so used to being hurt that they want to hurt somebody else before they have the opportunity to be hurt themselves.
Right. It's,
they're going on the offensive.
Right. And if the only control they have is to leave on their terms, then that's what they'll do.
Yep. Yep. And that was exactly what I did. That's teenage runaway.
Yeah. So, oh, runaways run away. I've been there. It's a coping mechanism.
Absolutely.
It's what they do.
Yep. It's the only control you have in your life at that moment.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what is the doctrine of logical consequences?
Well, it is letting kids get a glimpse of how the world works in a very safe way. We as adults like to go to what is easy for us, which is, in other words, you know, we can always lecture because lecture is very easy for us. But it doesn't affect kids. I mean, you know, the old joke from Charlie Brown, all the adults, it's, you know, sound. Exactly. That's the way kids translate our lectures, and they just wait it out. But if you say to them, okay, this is the logical consequence of what happens. And so we set up logical consequences in a very safe way. So to take, for example, I always liked to give my kids allowances based on their grades or work around the house, or, you know, they could earn money because that's what happens. If you do a good job in the workforce, you get more money.
Right.
So I kind of set it up that way with, you know, they could do extra chores or get better grades or whatever, and it translated into money. But the other foundation for that was that it also gave me something to take away. So when one of my kids would skip the school bus, I would say, well, I'm dropping you off, but it's $5 taxi service. I'm not charging you my lawyer's rates, but, you know, somebody's got to pay for this gas because of a decision you made. Or if they plunked out of a grade. And again, now these were kids who were perfectly capable of getting the good grades. If they had learning difficulties or some other thing, then I wouldn't go there with the logical consequences. But if it was kids who just didn't do their homework or just didn't feel like showing up in class or whatever, then they had to pay for what it cost to go to summer school if they wanted to go to summer school. And so I always looked for things that sort of just the way the world works. You know, one of our kids one time lied to us about having been doing homework, and we got online and found out hadn't been doing the homework. So I just went through this, I can't trust you now. So I didn't lock them down. I didn't say you have a curfew or you have this. It's just every time they asked to do something, I'd think about it and say, well, if I could trust you, you could go next door to play with so-and-so. But since I can't trust you, you have to stay home where I can see you. Or, yeah, I know your normal curfew is 9 o'clock, but I want to go upstairs and I don't want to have to come back down and make sure that you have your lights turned off. So you have to turn off and go to bed at 7:30. And the kid did not realize how much of the life was based on somebody being able to trust him until they didn't have that trust anymore.
Wow.
And that it was actually our youngest son who, another year or so later, I said, something came up and I said, are we going to have trust issues again? And he said, oh, no. you scarred my soul last time. We will never have trust issues ever again.
Oh my gosh. How old was he?
12 or 13.
Oh my gosh. What a great age to learn that lesson, man. Catch them while they're still young enough.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, we just kind of do that with kids. You know, again, with summer school or kids who miss the bus. And I had kids who would miss the bus and then start insisting, no, I have to get there on time. Looking at them like, I'm sorry, you missed the bus. Now you're stuck with my schedule, which is half an hour late, and I'm sorry, but I'm not going to change it just for you. So I didn't quite say it that way, but I just said,
Right.
you miss the bus, you're stuck with whatever you can get, and this is the best I can do.
Yep.
So, I remember having a conversation with my granddaughter who was rude to me one day, and I just said, remember this conversation because when I tell you I don't do favors for people who are rude to me, this is what I'm talking about. And she just blew it off until the next day when she needed me to take her to school. It wasn't school. It was something that she could live without, maybe going to, do some shopping or whatever. And I just looked at her and said, remember, I told you I don't do things to people who are nice to me, who are rude to me. And you still haven't apologized for being rude to me. So no.
Wow. It's nice.
Just small kind of things like that, because that's what happens when kids are rude to other people. They pull away from them. So that's the logical consequences that I'm, and again, you have to do it safely. If you have a child who's, we always had our kids fix their own lunch, and if they forgot their lunch at school, oh well, I'm too busy to bring it to you. You'll just have to do something when you get home. But with kids who have suffered from food insecurity, you can't go there. It's not emotionally safe. So you do have to find logical consequences that are safe for the kids.
Right. And it's not a one size fits all
Right.
either. You need to be able to cater it to whichever child it is that you're dealing with at the time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
As my brother said one time, you have to find what their currency is.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And everybody has their own separate love languages, and no two kids are ever going to be the same, even with similar circumstances.
Right, exactly.
In some of our earliest correspondence, I had asked a question about this whole process, and you said that learning about how trauma affects the kids gave you more patience. Was this a slow, gradual learning lesson, or was this something that all came kind of at once and kind of took your breath away?
Oh no, it's very slow.
Yeah.
I am not by nature a patient person. I always tell people who are thinking about being foster parents, look, if a left-brained empathy challenged lawyer can do this, then anyone can do it. But what gave me patience was understanding that the kids were not always in control of these annoying, obnoxious behaviors. And it's a fine balance you have to figure out. I mean, kids who've suffered trauma are not angels, and they have the same obstreperous, oppositional, defiant kind of things that every other kid does. But you have to figure out how much of this is a trigger that they're not in control of, and how much of it is something that they can control, and you have to help them control what they can, and then with the practice and the skills, they start controlling more of their responses and what's going on. And it's always a two step forward, one step back with any sort of learning thing like that.
I know for myself, for a while, especially as a teenager, I used my own traumas as kind of a crutch. I used it
Oh,
as
yeah.
my get out of free jail card. And if I say, well, this reminds me of XYZ, even if it didn't. I could
Right.
absolutely manipulate the people around me to do and to say and to feel what I wanted them to do, say, or feel. I have
Right.
no doubt you've come across this dozens of times.
Yes. And sometimes you can work with it and say, I don't think so, not today. Other times I could say, look, I get that this was a reaction that you didn't have control over, but there are still consequences because decisions and life actions have consequences. And so not punishment, I'm still here for you, but you're still grounded. Or whatever. And then to work with them on, schools would just, they don't really quite understand. With kids with anxiety, they sort of would say, okay, well, you can leave the classroom and go for a break. I'm like, no. What do you mean go for a break? It's just like a set in excuse here.
Yeah.
We all need to do the tough work here of learning how to deal with this anxiety.
Right.
So, and there's a lot of times when you just say to kid, look, I know this is tough, but I'm sure you can get through it. And I expect you to get through it, and you will get through it. And you just expect them to succeed. And if they don't, that's okay. We'll try again. But you don't change the expectation that they will succeed eventually. Sometimes you just have to set it up for them that I don't know how long it's going to take us to get here, but this is where we're going to go, and I don't ex you know, and I expect you will not give up before we get there.
Right. That's awesome. How difficult is the process to become a foster parent?
It depends on the state. There are some, there's always this tension between they need foster parents, they want all sorts of people to be foster parents, and then they face the liability of lawsuits if they get bad foster parents through there. So it sort of depends. I always recommend to people who are thinking about being foster parents that you get into foster care the same way you learn how to swim, which is you start in the shallow water first. So you can work as a respite care parent, for example. That's what I did originally. Take kids for short periods of time, emergency care, or you're paired up with another family, and you take the kid on weekends to give that family a rest. Or if, for example, the family has an older kid who's going on college orientation, going to look at colleges and going to trips to check out the colleges, then the younger child stays with you for that period of time. So that is a good way to figure out what's going on. You have limited responsibility. You have a mentoring family to work with. You can see it from the inside without taking on more than what you're expecting.
What a beautiful way to start looking into getting into that world. When I became a foster parent last year, I didn't know if it was going to be for a short period of time or if it was going to be for the next, 30 years of my life. She was a special
Right.
needs kiddo. And my husband and I, we were newlyweds and we were looking at each other going, this isn't what I signed on for, but
Oh, I
she
know.
needs somebody and she knows us.
Right.
So, as much as there was a mild hesitation in the very beginning, it was quickly squashed. It was, nope, she's ours. And from what I understand, you've never had any biological children of your own, but you've collected seven kids and now 10 grandchildren. Holy cow. Do you guys all hang out? Are some of these your stepkids and your foster kids? Do you get together and celebrate holidays?
Well, several, two of the, actually three of the kids live out of state, and so it's very difficult to get everybody together. And it's a combination of my foster kids and stepkids. And two of the kids don't speak to us for reasons that we can't fix and we can't help.
Right.
So I want to say to all those people out there who are facing kids who have rejected them, I've been there. I know what you're talking about. I would still try. If I had it to do all over again, I would still try
Yeah.
and see what I could do, because these kids needed someone.
Right.
So with all of those factors, we get together in smaller groups. One of my out of state kids, I packed up the entire family, my kids, spouse, and grandkids, and we went to Disney World for a week a few years ago. The kids who were in the area, we get together and you know, try to have cookouts and dinners and stuff like that. My husband and I keep talking about going back to weekly family get-togethers and dinners. We just haven't gotten our schedule worked out where we can clear up the same day every week.
Right. Man, that sounds like a blast, though. A week at Disney World. Oh, my gosh.
It was a great bonding time because, you know, with kids out of state, you just have you have a hard time getting together. So an entire week together, it was very nice.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm one of those people that I don't have any kind of a relationship with my family these days. And it's mm-hmm. tough, you know. Mm-hmm. And I can see that if I had remained in the foster care system when I was 17, I probably would have bonded with that family enough to where I would have had a sense of stability with them. And I probably would have wanted to stay in contact with them. I still miss those people. They were mm-hmm. so good to me. They were kind and gentle and understanding and gave me the space and the independence that I needed while also still giving me this list of chores and showing me that if I want to be a part of the family, this is what it was going to take. Right. I needed that stability so badly in my teen years. And I just love that these kids are still a part of your life today. They just speak so highly of who you are and who you've taught them who you are.
That's well, they even the ones who have decided to reject us, we've always tried to make clear, you know where we are. And, mm-hmm. you know, we're always on Team Kid. I may disagree with you and current decisions, I can't go with you where you're going, but we're here. Whenever you want to come back, you know where to find us, and we will, you know, always care about you. So, this is, you know, all of my kids make, we always say to them, look, I'm disagreeing with this decision, but I'm on Team Kid and we're behind you, whatever.
You know? Right. You're the bonus family.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So, and I do have a great relationship with the other kids. So you know, 5 out of 7 is not a bad average, and
right.
you just keep doing. Actually, we don't have foster kids right now, but we have signed up with a group that, and you actually, Mena, may appreciate this, of kids who have aged out of the system but have signed up for mentors. And so we're doing a lot of mentoring now with older young adults.
And we spoke briefly before we jumped into the recording today about the movie Shazam. The second film, they're talking about exactly this issue with kids aging out of the foster care system and not mm-hmm. having anywhere to go. I remember just a couple of days ago, my husband and I were watching that second film. And he looked at me and he had this look on his face of absolute pain. That this can't be true. This can't be real. And I told him, no, this is absolutely real. When kids age out of the system, they've got nowhere to go. If that foster family doesn't decide to take them on themselves and to keep them as their own children, they have nowhere because the state's not going to be paying this family to take care of them anymore. And if this family is already barely getting by, guess what? They can't afford to feed this mouth that's no longer providing an income to be able to do so.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that hurts so deeply. It hurts so bad. And I love that there's programs out there that are able to do that, that are offering these services and that you've signed up for.
Well, it was cool. Nice. Yeah. Our last placement, was exhausting. And, I will also say to foster parents or people who are thinking about foster parenting, in many ways, it was much easier for me to be a foster parent as a married person because I had that extra pair of hands and that backup. But then there were the times when this wonderful, rational, loving, generous man that I married got it all wrong and wouldn't listen to me and wouldn't pay attention to what I was trying to say. And so what is this, having a different opinion? So I did have to learn how to navigate that.
It's just having another kid in the house, right? That's, you know, they're opposing point of view.
That's right. Like, wait, I have raised teenagers. I can do this. So after our last placement, when my husband said, "Do you want to get back into foster care?" I said, "Let's look at this mentoring thing for a while." So
Yeah.
that's the season of life that we're in now.
That is really cool. I love that. And Debbie, have you got a copy of your book with you? Or would you be willing to do a little bit of a reading from your book?
Yes. I can. I've pulled out actually the end of my book, because where I talk about Plan B is not second best, and because I talk a lot about the challenges of being a foster parent, and but I wanted to end on a positive note. So the part that I pulled is from my last chapter, where I say that even after we make the transition from our original plans to Plan B, we may find the new plan to be more challenging and difficult than we expected. We may need to learn new skills, forge new relationships. We may experience difficult failures that we need to learn from. Nothing about that process is easy. I certainly had no idea what I was getting myself into when I started raising other people's children. If I had foreseen all of the arguments, sleepless nights, heart-wrenching separations, and deep sadness that I would experience, I do not know if I would have had the courage to take the first step. Fortunately, I'm glad that I did not have the opportunity to chicken out. In the midst of my challenges, I have learned lessons that I would not trade for anything, much less an easier life. My children have made me much stronger, a much stronger, more compassionate, and loving person. I've also found joy and love that have kept me going. I keep a veritable treasure trove of messages and cards that my kids have given me over the years. And whenever I despair of my ability to help them, the notes remind me why I should not give up. Thank you for always being there when I need you. You've taught me a lot of what it means to love myself. I love you so much, I take out the trash most of the time. Thank you for all the hard work you do and being there whenever I need a shoulder to wipe snot on. Not all of these children were able to sustain these insights. Not all of them have been able to overcome their trauma. But for the moment, I was able to connect with them and show them a different future than they had seen for themselves. Even the children who broke my heart taught me invaluable lessons about myself and how to parent other children. I grieve for their losses, but I would not have passed up the opportunity to know and love them. That message really is the core of raising other people's children. My life has not gone as I planned it, but it has been more abundant than any of my plans. My children have enriched my life beyond anything I ever could have imagined. And despite all of the challenges and difficult days, I would do it all again in a heartbeat.
If you've enjoyed tonight's episode, please make sure you check out the episode description. There you'll find links on how you can learn more about this guest, links to connect with them on social media, and how to support the podcast. Remember, I don't get paid to do this. My boss is a bit tight-fisted. I can say that. I work for myself. In short, this show really is all about the guest. If you've enjoyed their interview, please feel free to let them know. You can also tune in to my other podcast, Growth from Darkness, which is co-hosted by a lovely lady from Australia. We talk about what trauma responses are and healthy ways to move beyond the past. For more information, just go to growthfromdarkness.com. You can also follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/growthfromdarkness.